The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Max, and this is Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the pod today, Champions League with Liverpool and Celtic and some foreign. Championship struggles for Villa as Vincent Tan, George Mendes and Mick McCarthy FC keep their 100% records. The Premier League preview, including Spurs, Chelsea, with Wembley being 1 metre wider than White Hart Lane, but Chelsea not having any players. Zidane doesn't criticise Ronaldo for pushing the ref, but Barcelona are useless. Sid will tell us everything. Plus transfer window rumours, transfer window changes and egg stop play. All today, just for you, on Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We have a panel. Jacob Steinberg.
Hello.
First pod of the season. Welcome.
Thank you.
Notice anything different?
No, good. Nothing at all.
We'll touch on it in detail, but briefly, out of 10, what's your West Ham optimism currently?
Right now, after Sunday, probably one.
Okay. it's higher than I thought, actually. Paul McInnes.
Hello there.
Norwich won last night.
Yeah, we did.
Well done.
Yeah, didn't play that well, apparently, but took the chances. And that's all you need.
It's all about results.
Yep.
Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
I've never had more praise, which is not a lot of praise, but below the line, for swearing at you on Monday.
Yeah, that seemed to go down well. So if things are going south, just throw in an F-bomb.
That might be my thing, you know. Some people have puns. Let's start with part one, shall we? Champions League, Hoffenheim 1, Liverpool 2. What did you make of this game, Jacob?
I thought that there were times, certainly in the first half, when you could tell Liverpool's defensive frailties were perhaps there to be got at. A bit lucky with the penalty. That was an awful penalty and a fairly easy save, I thought, for Mignolet. At the same time, you could see that the pace they've got up front is going to be a big factor for them this season. I thought Salah, despite being a bit wasteful, looked dangerous again. And they suddenly seem to have unearthed this, finally, a gem who from the youth academy. Been waiting a while, I think, since Gerrard, for someone to properly come through. It looks like Trent Alexander-Arnold might be potentially someone who could make a...
Putting all this pressure on him.
He's the new Cafu, obviously. Yeah. and probably the new Roberto Carlos after that free kick as well. But he was taking all the set pieces on Tuesday night. And he has, throughout his briefer spells in the team, looked quite solid. There was a lot of fears about him before when they went to Old Trafford in January, and he dealt with Martial pretty well on that occasion, and he seems to be very assured for someone so young. So he seems to be one for the future, certainly.
Paul McInnes.
There's always that sort of stuff, the mythology around young players coming through, that, you know, they spend hours on the training ground, etc. And that is what's been the Klopp was saying after the game about Alexander-Arnold, but also that he has competitions with Ben Woodburn to take free kicks, and Woodburn is the other young academy prospect that I think everybody's excited about. And I wondered whether that was Klopp framing it, saying, you know, you can look to see these two players coming into the side this year. But yeah, Alexander-Arnold is not short of confidence. I think he's been telling Klein he wants his place for 6 months. And it's rare you see a free kick. I mean, it was a great free kick, you know, just kind of swinging in the air and just going inside the post. It's rare you see it go so low. Mm. It's like usually top bin, and this was like bottom bin. And it was a great strike. I mean, I thought Liverpool deserved to win the game. Fourth finish in the Bundesliga versus fourth place in the Premier League, and I thought Liverpool deserved to win. That's not a bad position to be at this start of the season.
I'm always slightly dubious when managers say, you know, and players talk about it about their teammates, you know, he's the last one on the training ground. Because surely at every club there are two people that want to practice free kicks. And if you've got two of them that are the last on the training ground, then they're always going to be on the training ground, aren't they? They're never Beckham and, you know, Scholes are never going to leave.
There's this great line in Stuart James's big piece about Gylfie Sigurdsson, which is a really good read. If anybody hasn't, just ahead of the move to Everton, he wrote it. But he was saying the same thing, you know, he's always, every day he would want to practice free kicks. But the way it was told was through the reserve goalkeeper, who had to be there to kind of stand there for the free kicks. And every day he'd go past him and go, today? And Gylfie would go, yes. And they'd have to go out on the training ground.
I want to hear about the guys who, you know, he's always first off the train.
Exactly. I think that's Mark Viduka, yeah. If I remember correctly. What did you make of that game, Baz? Anything?
I thought Hoffenheim had probably... I expected them to be better than they were, but they were okay, and yeah, Liverpool won, but their shortcomings were still painfully evident. But at least they saved a penalty, which shows they're good at defending set pieces again.
Celtic won tremendously, Barry. It's a very early time for Fit Bar Corner. Can it live up to such an early billing? No. It's the answer there, isn't it? Why are you looking at me like that? Your eyes have gone.
Sorry,
thin.
I wasn't expecting you to spring Fitba corner on me.
Oh, well, Celtic but won.
Yeah, it was a hugely emphatic victory. Like, as I said on Monday, I didn't know anything about Astana. They're obviously not very good, and that tie is all but over, barring an absolute disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Celtic, I think, had like 7 efforts on goal in total. I mean, they scored 5, 2 were own goals, but they're just the way in which Astana kept giving them the ball. But I just think this Celtic project under Rodgers is just really interesting. I mean, Olivier and Cham, they're signing from Man City in the summer, about 5 million. French midfielder, 6 foot, can spray a pass all over the pitch. He's done, again, what he did with Dembele last season, really astute signings. And they can be like, if they get in the Champions League every year, then, you know, they become a different prospect for young players who might want to develop their careers. And that you could see them being more of a sort of Bayern Munich of the North, where, you know, they still can still have a very good squad because they can always offer elite competition for players.
Paul, have you ever considered doing a Fitbar Corner style part of a pod?
I haven't, no, I haven't.
Are you interested?
I've got my championship minute. I researched the championship ahead of a prospective championship.
I'm just
discussion. Thinking
as the pod, you know, evolves. Could you do championship and Fitbar Corner? I mean,
I've been sacked.
Oh, Max, I've got my sights set higher than just Fitbar Corner.
Really?
Don't you worry about
is
that.
Is that right? Yeah. There is a hole for Serie A if anyone's interested. Let's go on to the championship then. It's all right, Barry. You can keep Fitbar Corner for now. It's not a decision for me, though.
I mean, the thing is, it would have been a huge blow for Celtic not to qualify. You know, the season would be a bit meh. They're going to win the championship by a tight at a canter, you know, 30 points or whatever. And if they hadn't got this, plus it's beneficial for the rest of the clubs in Scotland, because I think they all get 250 grand on the back of Celtic qualifying, which, you know, they will, barring an absolute disaster.
And with that bit of knowledge, you've wrestled Fitbar Corner back. Unless, Jacob, you want to make a pitch for Fitbar Corner?
No, I'm okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Jacob doesn't want to have to take an interest in Fitbar.
Championship minute then, Paul.
Well, you look at the league tables, early days, only 3 games, but it's an unfamiliar look with Cardiff at the top, followed by Wolves, and then Ipswich, Middlesbrough in 4th, Forest in 5th, which is a surprise as well, and Sunderland in 6th. So, 2 of those, well, I mean, I think a lot of people thought Sunderland would be chaotic, but they haven't been. But only of the big names expected, only Middlesbrough and Wolves are up there. And Wolves have hit the ground running, 3 wins out of 3. Ruben Neves, £15 million from Porto, scored an absolute pearler, 25 yards outside to open the scoring in their match away at Hull. They've got talent all over the pitch, particularly going forward. Diogo Jota on loan for Atletico Madrid scored his first goal. I saw him play against Borough the other week. Looks a very tidy player. Academy prospect Bright Eno Bakari on the other wing. He's having a great start to the season. There's, you know, all these big money Portuguese signings, but they've been bedded in with some good English players. 2 wingbacks, very good as well. They look solid. They've hit the ground running. They know their style. I think Wolves are already sort of laying down a marker and will be interesting to watch going forward. Middlesbrough, patchy. But Britt Sombalonga got his first goals for the club in their win this week. And he is, you know, I think he's probably the best striker in the division and certainly a great signing for them. Cardiff, I mean, they're the big surprise.
They go to Wolves on Saturday in a title decider.
Well, indeed. I mean, you know, it'll be interesting because just the one thing I'd say about Wolves is in the 2 goals they conceded against Hull, the ball in the air is the question, you know, and that's what you get more of in the Championship. And both goals sort of bobbled around in the box. Nobody could really clear it. And guess what Neil Warnock likes to do? Stick the ball in the box. But he's got a rejuvenated Junior Hoylett playing for them, and he's got a bit more quality in the squad than last year. Lee Tomlin's also joined them. So I think it will be an interesting test for Wolves' credentials against Cardiff. And then, you know, loath as I am to say it, Ipswich Town doing very well. Done it on absolutely bugger all money. They brought in a pair of strikers this summer, Martin Waghorn, Joe Garner. Waghorn scored a brace in midweek and they cost less than £2 million between them, which, given that Asombalonga is like £15 million, Mick still knows how to do deals and he's still got team spirit there. So Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting start to the season.
There are some sort of nasty football fans who are enjoying John Terry being in a very struggling Aston Villa side. How big a crisis do people see this as?
Potentially, yeah. One point from three games. They lost at Reading on Tuesday night, and already there are doubts over Steve Bruce's future. And so you could make the comparison perhaps with Rio Ferdinand at QPR, how he bombed there and didn't do much and really struggled from that drop down. And that was in the Premier League, so it was a slightly higher level, obviously, that he was playing at. But still, John Terry didn't play much football last season. Clearly, there was a reason for that. Antonio Conte looked at him and thought that he wasn't able to cut it at that level. And, you know, you can't underestimate the Championship. There are a lot of good forwards there. And as you say, someone like a Sombalonga, you know, it's not such a big difference between that and the lower end of the Premier League. And Villa have been so on such a downward spiral for quite such a long time that to get out of it is going to take a really, really long job. And you wonder how much time that Steve Bruce is going to be given to get that all back together. At the moment, we have seen teams drop through the divisions in the past. I don't think Villa, the way they've been going in the past 2 or 3 years, can have any illusions about how tough a job this is at the moment.
You can't imagine Villa in League One.
Yeah, but could you imagine Leeds or Forest in League
One
as well?
Yes, I can imagine all that. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Now, I think it's a bit early to panic. Roy Keane got Sunderland out of the Championship as champions, and when he took that job, I think they were bottom of the table, having got one or possibly no points out of the first six games. And Steve Bruce has got a lot of problems to sort out with Villa, you know, getting rid of Deadwood, trying to keep the rest of the Deadwood he has there reasonably happy. And things could get a whole lot worse, but I would say preach caution.
They got turned over by Reading. It was a relentless assault by the home side. And they, you know, they were organised, Villa, but they didn't look cohesive. And one of the things, you know, he's nearly been there a year now, Steve Bruce, and he's churned over so many players. You look at the bench, Albert Adoma on there, Chris Samba on there, Henry Lansbury on there. That, you know, these are all players who've been bought in the last year. There's more new signings. They've brought Josh Onoma in from Spurs, who effectively going to play in the same position as Jack Grealish. Who's your number one choice in pretty much most positions on the pitch, apart from John Terry, who's going to start? I think they've got lots of issues to deal with.
Tom has sent us a tweet going, Coventry top of League 2 with 100% record and no goals conceded. Is our elusive top 6 finish on the cards this year? In a word, Barry.
I hope so.
Leighton Orient have had a mixed start in the National League or whatever it's called now. Lost away at Sutton 2-0, beat Solihull Moors 3-1 and Maidstone 2-0. But this week they lost 6-1 away at Bromley. And a Bromley fan wanted me to mention that.
Quick word for Oxford as well.
Yeah, with Pep Clotet.
Yeah, Pep Clotet, exactly. Mm. The former assistant at Leeds. I think they're 100%, I think, at the top of League One.
Who wants to run us through the Eni Aluko story? Anybody?
Eni Aluko, for anyone who doesn't know, she's 102 caps for England. Sister of Sonny Aluko, who plays for Fulham. She was paid £80,000 to sign an agreement not to speak about an incident in which the England women's team manager Mark Sampson is alleged to have used an analogy that had, quote, derogatory, racial and prejudicial connotations to another player. So the FAA had an internal investigation about this, commissioned a confidential independent inquiry, and her complaint wasn't upheld. And they found no case for disciplinary action and decided not to take action against Mark Sampson. So now the FA, basically, according to Daniel Taylor's story, which is on the main lead story on the front page of today's Guardian, they're going to have to explain why they went to such extraordinary lengths to prevent this case becoming public. And, you know, why did they give her 80 grand hush money? Basically, and they also gave her a central contract, despite her saying she would never play for England as long as Mark Sampson was in charge.
So the hush money was what until the tournament had finished?
Their excuse is that they wanted to avoid disruption in the build-up to the women's Euros. So England reached the semi-final. But it seems an extraordinary amount of money. And I would also question, if Eni Aluko feels as strongly about this as she claims to, why did she take the money?
And also the accusation is weird, isn't it? That she wasn't there,
Yeah,
but he made a comment to someone else about how she'd been arrested four times.
Yeah. When in fact she had never been arrested at all. Is a mixed race player, newish member of the squad, who hasn't been named, but I don't think you don't have to be a genius to figure out who it is. But he made a comment during a training session about, you know, getting tight on your man or woman in the same way a police officer would if he was arresting you, and then made this comment to this girl from South London about her having been arrested four times, when in fact she had never been in trouble with the police at all.
I think we all saw from the Women's Euros that Mark Sampson is a bit of a liability with his mouth. You know, he said things about two different coaches, one of which sort of worked in his favour, one of which very much didn't. And he has, I think, you know, over the course of his reign, he has been divisive. I interviewed Rachel Yankee recently, and Rachel Yankee was basically, you know, she's 120 caps for England and was basically cut dead, just like you're not playing again. The door's always open, etc. But she wasn't going to be playing for England again, and that hurt her quite a lot. Now, I think there's a line you could say which says Sampson has made these decisions because he wants to build a squad around certain people, and he wants to build squad unity, and he doesn't. He's going to concentrate on the players that he wants in the squad. That might have consequences for him with the players who no longer play for him as well. I do think the fact it's second hand, wasn't directly at her, is something that struck with me reading that story. But, you know, he hasn't come back at the point, you know, on the pitch. He hasn't delivered in the end what he was talking about. You know, they were at least looking to get to the final. They were talking about winning it and they didn't get that close. I think Sampson's now, you know, under real pressure in his role.
That'll do for part one. In a moment, part two, but before that, some adverts. Welcome back to part two of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We'll look at the Premier League games in just a second. What do you make of this moving the transfer window? I think it was Karen Brady tweeted or said that 17 out of 20 clubs now want to move the transfer window, have agreed that they want to move the transfer window before the start of the season. They need 14 votes to pass the new rule. It does seem sensible, Jacob, but then if you're not in line with the rest of Europe, there are potential problems with it.
Yeah, potentially another thing that might come into play is that managers are going to have to be a lot more decisive around what they do earlier in the transfer window. And again, is that potentially going to drive prices up if clubs have even more of a hint of desperation about them when they're trying to do these deals? But yeah, I think that once you get into the season and you're still not sure about how teams are going to look come the end of August, by which time they'll have played three games, after which they can't actually do anything about it, even if they've made some signings or not done anything, it does slightly skew the competition. I think personally I'd be in favour of just getting rid of it altogether. It's always just hard just to predict when you're asked to give your predicted table to know what to do, because you get asked at the start of August and there's still so much that could happen.
That's the reason to get rid of the window. Save the bloody journalists.
Save me from trying to work out what Tottenham are going to look like come the end of the transfer window. You know, still not made any signings.
Where then, in your predicted table did you put West Ham?
West Ham, I think, somewhere around mid-table.
Okay.
I think
you revised that?
Ask me on Monday.
Okay.
Well, I think it just shows, I think there's something about it. I agree with Jacob, but I think it just shows where we're at with fetishizing of signings, you know, announce somebody. It's like it becomes so important about who you are adding to the squad. We're talking about, you know, potential, you know, 9 points max that it might affect, but that so much time and thought is spent on recruitment nowadays that this is seen as a real crucial determinant on the course of your season. Whereas obviously if you say you are Pochettino and you don't sign anybody but you keep coaching him very well, then you might win those first three games and then you're off to a really good start despite not having bought anybody.
The only thing I'd say is that unless it's coming into line with the rest of Europe, it won't work, you know. I don't like to see clubs starting the season with their best players not involved because they're either sulking or being protected ahead of a move or are suffering from some mysterious ailment in inverted commas when quite clearly there's nothing wrong with them. Hello, Virgil. But yes.
I was just about to say, I was saying on the radio yesterday, if it happened worldwide, would it be like New Year, you know, where the window, it finishes in Australia an hour before, at the right at the start, and they have fireworks, and then so you could...
Jim White would love that.
Yeah.
Or you could hand over to, like, international versions of Jim White as the transfer window kind of closes. You could have this.
Max and I saw a side of Jim White yesterday that we'd never seen before.
No. He threw a hard-boiled egg off the Eiffel Tower.
As a child...
Well, he could have killed someone.
Yeah, because of the velocity, with gravity.
Hmm. Well, I mean, even a soft-boiled egg.
Okay, where did he get it from? Was he
with the egg?
Yeah,
we didn't ask these sort of forensic journalistic questions.
A hard-boiled egg around with him.
Packed lunch on his school trip.
Well, that's exactly right.
Okay,
well done.
And then, what would happen if you threw a fried egg off the Eiffel Tower?
Would it disintegrate?
I think maybe. Yeah. Burn up.
Depends how fried it is. If it's over easy or. Sunny side up.
Over easy.
I now have this urge to go up the Eiffel Tower with a big box of eggs and a range of skillets and saucepans and stuff.
The reason they were talking about this was because in the week, a ref was forced to stop play. Did you see this story? Nantwich versus Altrincham.
Threw an egg from the Eiffel Tower.
No, but someone was stood outside the Evo Stick North Club's Weaver Stadium and was hurling eggs over the stand into the ground. Here's the tweet from Altrincham FC. 13 minutes, play stopped. Believe because eggs are being thrown onto the pitch from outside the ground. Bizarre. Following tweet at 8:03 p.m. Yep, they're eggs. This is weird. It finished 1-1. In 2006, a more serious incident saw an arrow being fired into the ground in the same game.
Yeah, I was going to say, people don't throw enough eggs nowadays. It's all rocks.
Yeah. Eggs are okay. I think a bow and arrow is probably a step too far. Right, Spurs-Chelsea, arguably the biggest game of the weekend, Sunday at 4 o'clock. Lots of people saying this is just a great time for Spurs to play Chelsea. Too many people are saying that, and so Chelsea will invariably win 1-0.
That's my take.
Is that your take?
No, my take is it's a good time to play them.
Okay.
Yeah. But this time last week I was talking about that Chelsea can roll over everybody and win the title and stuff, and then, you know, I still kind of believe that they're title contenders, but... The Harry Kiri in that first half against Burnley suggests that mentally they're not quite at the races yet, which means it probably would be a good time for Spurs to play them.
Jacob? It was a good time for Spurs to play them when they played them in the FA Cup semi-final last year at Wembley, and Chelsea won 4-2, even though Hazard and Costa started on the bench. But I think that this is arguably an even better time to play them after, as Paul said, what happened against Burnley last weekend, which those goals had distinct whiff of the 2015 title challenge about them. And Spurs looked good on the weekend against Newcastle, even though they were helped by Jonjo Shelvey's assist. If Morata starts, perhaps the way he looked when he came on in the second half against Burnley, he looked very promising. We know that he's a good player, probably an upgrade on Michy Batshuayi, who I don't think covered himself in glory against Burnley. And you obviously have to factor in the Wembley factor for Tottenham, whether they're going to be able to play there and prosper in the way that they did last season at White Hart Lane, which was such a huge factor for them.
I've got some
best record in the league.
Yeah, I've got some Wembley stats. Are we interested in these Wembley stats? This is from Sky data journalist Adam Smith. I should credit him because he did all this work and I'm just stealing it. So White Hart Lane was 67 metres wide and 100 metres long, and Spurs did want to change Wembley to those exact parameters. They couldn't, but they have made it slightly smaller. They'll be playing on a pitch that's 5 metres longer and a metre wider than White Hart Lane. And he did a big statistical analysis, which on...
Five metres longer?
Yeah.
White Hart Lane was a small
pitch. It was small. Do you want to know? There are basically, you have to have... your pitch has to be a certain dimension if it can fit in the stadium. There are five teams that pitches are smaller. Do you want to guess what they are? Smaller than the 105, 68 metre that you are meant to have.
I'd say Bournemouth.
No. Anyone else?
Hull had one, but they got relegated.
They did, yeah.
Chelsea.
Correct. Is anyone enjoying the quiz?
You're going to continue with this.
Yeah.
Everton.
Everton, correct.
Watford.
Nope.
Palace.
Palace, correct. A joint with Liverpool, both 101 times 68.
Old ground.
Yeah, and Huddersfield, the other one. But what he discovered was Spurs do struggle a bit more on a big pitch. Not offensively, right? They create the same amount of chances, but opposition teams have more shots against them because, well, there's a bit more space.
Yeah, a bit more space for them to run into.
Exactly. Yeah. Did you enjoy those stats?
Yes.
Thanks very much.
Yes.
But Chelsea don't have many players
It's also statistically quite an important
point. We were trying
point.
To work out just earlier who's going to play in central midfield exactly. because Bakayoko's injured, Fabregas is suspended after his show of petulance last weekend, and Matic doesn't play for them anymore. And Shalabar's gone, and Loftus-Cheek has gone, and Lewis Baker has gone.
Is there a youngster, Mason Mount? Is he a central midfielder? I mean, he's out on loan, but...
Charlie Musonda.
Chelsea supporting pal of mine reckons he's a future England captain.
It's a great name.
Mason Mount, yes.
Man City in for Johnny Evans. Sam writes, would City spending $80 million on Johnny Evans be a panic buy?
No.
Okay.
I read in the story that Sir Alex Ferguson was very surprised when Van Gaal sold him to West Brom in, 2015? He'd always been good, apart from that ear bashing he got at the San Siro when he was having a big load of problems with Huntelaar in the Champions League. But from Ferguson, when United equalised, Ferguson was effing and jeffing at him on the touchline, even though United had just scored. Probably language too blue for this podcast.
Not anymore.
Monday's...
not after Monday.
Yeah. But I was surprised that they did let him go. And I think that City, given that they have had problems at centre-back and they haven't really done much to solve it this summer so far, John Stones, I think, still has issues over his liking for the nastier side of the game. And you can't really trust company to stay fit. Otamendi hasn't really convinced. I think Johnny Evans has shown over quite a long period of time that he's been a very solid Premier League defender. And he's done really well for West Brom.
I saw City last weekend and they switched to a back three like everybody else. And I think there's a way in which that formation actually suits those three. It allows a bit more flexibility for company not to play. Stones can have people doing the aggressive stuff around him and Otamendi isn't exposed as much.
Yeah, I think just if you get Evans, you know exactly what you're buying, what you're going to get, a dependable, solid performer. Is prone to the odd moment of slapstick, but yeah, I wouldn't call it a panic buy at all.
What do we all think of Sigurdsson going to Everton? He's a lovely footballer.
Last off the training ground.
Absolutely.
I think it's a good buy. He's not fast, but I think he covered the most ground in the Premier League last season. He's a very clever player. Technically very gifted. He's going to play in that number 10. He's going to play where Barkley should have been able to play but never quite could.
So where's Rooney now playing?
Yeah, it's interesting how they're going to fit those two in there, because obviously they've got Sandro who's coming up to play up front. So how exactly they'll fit Sigurdsson and Rooney into the same team if they're going to play off the front would be...
You could play a three at the back and play two of them off of Sandro. You could obviously rotate. I mean, Rooney's not necessarily going to start every game. If they haven't bought him to play in that position, then you'd worry. But I think if... He knows that job there, and he's one of the most effective players in the Premier League at doing it.
He will not be playing for Swansea because he's not there anymore, and they play Manchester United, who are, the champions elect now after that win at the weekend. How do you see this one going, Barry Glendening?
I think Swansea might be in for a tricky time of it this season. There's talk that they're going to try and get Nasser Chadli from West Brom to replace Gylfi Sigurdsson. I presume they won't get him before Saturday, but... I think Swansea might struggle this season, and on the basis of Manchester United's win over West Ham, you'd obviously fancy them to win this game, even though they're away from home. But I wouldn't read too much into that game because West Ham were atrocious.
And let's go on to them. They go to Southampton. Jacob, the floor is yours. West Ham.
Well, there's also Southampton as well.
It's a good point.
Yeah, they haven't scored a home goal since April, start of April. But you'd imagine this might be, I think they broke a record for a barren run with the draw against Swansea on the weekend.
Six matches
at home and they haven't seen a goal. So I think they're still feeling maybe the after effects of Claude Puel, which obviously wasn't that exciting but for Southampton fans last season. But they do have good strikers, Gabbiadini and Austin. So you'd imagine they're going to get it together at some point. I was concerned about West Ham's transfer business in the summer when they had that great week when they signed Joe Hart, Arnautovic and Hernandez in the space of a few days, and talk of this is the best window ever. But you looked at it and wonder about the short-term approach. These players are all quite old. I'm not sure you're going to get much sell-on value from them. They'd already signed Pablo Zabaleta, who on the weekend did not look like the answer at right back, and they haven't really sorted out their defence. The last six signings they've made, if you don't count the 18-year-old Montenegrin signing that they made last week, between 28 and 33 years old, and they've all been signed on either quite big wages or for quite a lot of money, which is an interesting approach.
Do they have-
especially, sorry, just given that Bilic at the end of last season said one of the things that he really wants to solve was the pace, which apart from Antonio, they don't have a lot of, but they haven't seemed to do that. So I think that they've probably got enough to be okay, but the manner of the performance rather than the scoreline itself against United was certainly concerning. And in what looks like a pretty even league, you could see them potentially struggling, because I think Bilic at times has really looked like he's not sure what he's doing.
I agree. I don't think it's going to be long before Bilic is under real pressure.
I'm only using Jose Font as an example here, but West Ham have an ability to take a player and make them worse at football.
Robert Snodgrass, same. I got a lot of stick last week for saying that Snodgrass was a good player, but he is a good player, but he's done nothing for West Ham.
Well, he had big boots to fill.
Yeah, the problem is that he was the... If they just signed Snodgrass as to be on the bench, then it would have been fine. But instead, they signed him to replace Payet, which...
He can't do the same.
No, he's not going to do the same, is he? Yeah.
You know, but he can do certain things. You've just got to, you know, and that's why I feel like with a lot of these signings is that are they going to get the best out of what all these players do in their distinctive way?
When is West Ham's first home game?
11th of September against Huddersfield.
Other fixtures, Burnley, West Brom. Rich says, can Burnley maintain the charge for the top four? I like your optimism, Richard. Huddersfield, Newcastle, Leicester, Brighton, Stoke, Arsenal, Bournemouth, Watford. Does anybody want to add anything about those particular fixtures?
Well, just Palace, after their horror show against Huddersfield, they travel to Anfield, and as if things hadn't started badly enough for Frank de Boer, who I thought looked genuinely shell-shocked in his post-match interview after the Huddersfield game, as in, crikey, what the hell just happened there? I genuinely don't think he saw that coming at all. But he's now lost Wilfred Zaha, who's got a knee injury and is expected to be out for at least 4 weeks. So that's a bit of a hammer blow for him.
Yeah, a lot of people more intelligent than me saying De Boer is not the right fit for Palace because of the way he wants to play football and the players he's got.
Who knows? But I mean, Palace were a massive problem club before Sam Allardyce saved them with classic Sam. You know, they had a bad attitude and they couldn't defend. Like, he managed to turn Wilfred Zaha, a player who was incredibly frustrating because you know the talent he's got, into the most consistent period of his career in the Premier League last season. And he was the most effective attacking player for Palace. They're missing him now. And, you know, Palace struggled to defend so badly. Can anybody see them going to Liverpool and getting anywhere near a clean sheet?
No, but they might score from corners.
Yeah.
I have to apologise to Crystal Palace, because on the pod last week, or Monday, I think, I was having a go at the club for putting out flags so people could wave to make it look like a great place. And actually, the flags were put out by the Crystal Palace Ultras, which I didn't know was a thing.
Homesdale.
Is that right?
Yeah, the Homesdale. They're the people who started bringing, not safe standing, but like safe singing back into grounds. And it's catching on.
So that's a good thing. I still thought it was strange. If you're behind someone with a flag, it's a bit annoying, isn't it?
Well, it's for the beginning of the game.
It's just for the first five minutes.
Brighton did it last Saturday as well. So you get a kind of a big image in the ground.
A nice photo for the papers and stuff.
Exactly.
So anyway, hold my hands up. Somebody told me to jog on Twitter because I'd got that wrong. Can't be right about everything. Right, that's the end of part two. In part three, we'll talk to Sid about Spanish stuff and a bit more foreign as well. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. This is part three, and let's begin by going to Sid in Spain. There's been a tweet from Chris, Sid, that says, has Sid submitted a formal transfer request yet? Will he go before the end of this window?
And am I rebelling? I've been made to go and train with the reserves. Who are our reserves? Do we have any?
Oh, that's a good question. That's probably Marcotti's lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sid, look, lots of people this morning. Now, the kickoff, right, was 11 p.m. Spanish time, right, which is absurd. I know if I was Spanish, I'd have a different body clock. But
well, this morning, honestly, right, I feel like I have a hangover without having drunk anything, and that is from just going and doing a game. It's not, you know, it's not from going out or anything. It's quite bonkers.
But did anybody care that it was at 11 p.m? I know they have a later culture than us, but I would be up in arms.
And particularly in August, You know, August is traditionally the month in Madrid where everyone disappears, and that's not quite the case. And it's not as extreme as it used to be. I mean, it used to be genuinely sort of 10 years or so ago, you would go around Madrid and there would be no one there.
Let's talk about the game. A lot of people saying Barcelona were terrible.
Well, I think that's true, and I think Real Madrid were very, very good as well. And Gerard Piqué said something I thought that was quite interesting after the game. He said it's the first time in the time that he's been at the club, which is 9 years, that he's felt inferior to Real Madrid. Now, obviously, lots of people say, hang on a minute, you're trying to claim that Real Madrid have never been the better team before, that Real Madrid have never outplayed you before. But I actually think he's got a point, by which, I mean, it's worth kind of distinguishing between a period in which Madrid played better, distinguishing between a period in which Madrid looked stronger, and the sense last night, which is not, you know, played better, were better, it's just are better. And I think that is more profound than just last night's performance. I think it's the sense that Barcelona are kind of on the edge at the moment. There's a real feeling of crisis. There's a disconnect between the club and the players. There's the damage that the departure of Neymar's done. There's the sensation over the last two or three years. And this is curious because, of course, I include myself in this, we used to criticise some of Real Madrid's transfer policy and the kind of determination and obsession with buying superstars. But you look at what's happened over the last 2-3 years, maybe even a little bit longer, and Madrid have definitely had the better of the transfer market. That midfield last night that completely dominated, midfield that used to be the kind of the heart of Barcelona's identity, that midfield, none of them cost more than €35 million. All of them are players that could once have fitted in to Barcelona's identity. And I think there is a sense that Barcelona have lost control now. And that, of course, leads people to point not just to the players and the manager, but more significantly, I think more accurately as well, at the board.
Sid, you said in the wake of the Neymar sale that you thought Barcelona should sit tight and not do anything rash. Have you revised that opinion in light of recent events? Because their superstars are aging and they look in real, real trouble.
Yeah, they do. They do. And Sergio Busquets said the other day that they should sign players and sign them now. And I wouldn't so much revise that opinion as put the caveat in, which is I don't think that the solution is to do nothing. But I don't think the solution is to feel obliged by the departure of Neymar to rush out and spend wildly and not get the right kind of players. And for example, the signing of Paulinho, lots and lots of people criticising Paulinho, poor Paulinho, about the only person who hasn't yet done anything wrong, that's not to say he won't, is kind of taking a lot of flack because of what he symbolises, this idea that you get a player that's not necessarily a Barcelona kind of profile, that's at the back end of his career, that is seen as fundamentally not good enough. And there's this sense that, well, what is it they're chasing and are they doing it for the right reasons? Now, in fairness to Barcelona, you know, their pursuit of Coutinho is pre-Neymar. This isn't a replacement for Neymar, but Neymar's departure makes it more pressing. Of course, Dembele is, although he's a player they're already interested in. But to take it back to the Real Madrid parallel, you know, you're not just talking about players who could have fit Barcelona's model, but Toni Kroos, a player who was interested in going to Barcelona, Luka Modric, a player who was interested in going to Barcelona, Marco Asensio, who scored that brilliant goal last night, who right now, you know, anywhere in world football looks like, well, if you wanted someone to replace Neymar, there's your guy. And this is someone that Barcelona didn't manage to finalise a deal that was basically all set up for €4 million. By the way, a load of English clubs also didn't want to pay the 3.5, I think it was, million euro buyout clause that he had at the time. So there's a sense that Barcelona are now doing things for the wrong reason. I think that's kind of my argument. It's not necessarily that they shouldn't sign and they don't need to sign. I think they do, but they shouldn't allow the Neymar situation to kind of, if you like, force going wild, force them into the market and spend all that money straight away.
Do you think Dembele is a good signing? Because I look at him and think he does fit the profile.
In theory, he fits the Neymar profile, yes. In theory, he does. But, you know, the departure of Neymar, I think, is beyond, in terms of the damage it does to him, it's beyond just the sense that Neymar went. It's what that says about Barcelona's ability to hold on to its best players, what it says about their status, what it says about their failure to put in a buyout clause that meant he was basically impossible to sign. I mean, we were talking about a buyout clause that was €222 million when Cristiano Ronaldo's is a billion. Well, Gareth Bale's is up near a billion as well, if I remember rightly from his recent renewal. So, you know, Real Madrid put transfer values on players. That means this player does not go unless we want him to. Barcelona were powerless to prevent Neymar from going. That does them a lot of damage. The players all said they didn't want him to go. And then Piqué admitted that players all knew since Messi's wedding that Neymar was going to go. No one thought to tell the board about it.
How bad can this be for Barcelona? I mean, is it they'll finish third and do okay in the Champions League, or could this be really disastrous? I don't know the depth of La Liga, but...
Well, look, I mean, I think if they finish third, that would be seen as disastrous. You know, if they finish third and don't compete for the title, that is disastrous. Finishing second and being a long way off Real Madrid is also disastrous.
Right.
I don't know, because obviously, look, if they do get in Dembele and Coutinho and Pep Segura, the general sporting football manager, I think they call is his official title, last night said, I quite like this, he said, we're very close to them, but until something's done and a deal's all signed off, I can't say anything. You appear to have just said quite a lot. And if a deal isn't done, saying that is not exactly going to encourage both Borussia Dortmund and Liverpool to say, yeah, take our player here and don't pay us too much for them. So I think with those two players, obviously they will be a strong side again. I think they will find a mechanism that works. But there is a sense of, if you like, kind of impending crisis. And Barcelona are always, like any club, subject to kind of, you know, the ball not going in. There's a great Spanish phrase, it's all about whether or not the ball wants to go in. And of course, that conditions everything. But the underlying problem is much more profound, and the kind of structural problem. And there are a lot of people now calling for the resignation of the president of Josep Maria Bartomeu. And to be honest with you, I think they're entitled to call for that.
Sid, is it just Bartomeu's fault, or have these bad decisions been a long time coming? Why do you think that there are these structural problems at the moment? Because it seems quite hard for Barcelona to...
One of the kind of analyses that's been done, or one of the assumptions that's been made, and I admit at times there's not always a big difference between assumption and analysis, is that this starts with an idea, and it starts with an idea of a current board that doesn't necessarily embrace the ideas that built Barcelona. So, for example, this is what I say about the signings. You can go and make the signings, but you need to be bringing players through. There needs to be a commitment to a certain approach. You need to tie up the right kind of players at the right kind of times. And they seem to have failed to properly control that. And they obviously signed Neymar and Suarez and Messi, and no one's ever going to complain about a forward line like that. But at the same time, that did undermine some of that sense of identity about control for the midfield. They perhaps didn't see or didn't deal with quickly enough the retirement of Xavi, the aging process for Andrés Iniesta, although, you know, I suppose you try and cling on to Iniesta, but the truth is that Iniesta is very, very near the end, and probably was near the end most of last season as well. But they signed Rakitic, who was a really, really good player for the right side of midfield when you had Messi and Dani Alves there, but maybe not as someone who carries that midfield from the right-hand side. And it feels like they've missed a number of opportunities to try and stay faithful to an idea and move on with it, which obviously invites the conclusion that's because they maybe don't entirely believe in the idea that most of us assumed was kind of like the, if you like, the kind of the foundation stone of what Barcelona are.
Sid, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Top man, Sid Lowe.
Cheerio.
Out in Spain. Do you want to look at... the Bundesliga or Serie A?
Well, Bundesliga, Bayern Munich are in crisis.
In what way? Because I've got the top five teams to look out for from the Denver Post, which are the teams that finished in the top four, and Hamburg, who lost to Osnabrück and are out of the German Cup and will struggle. Even though there's a clock in the corner of Hamburg Stadium that counts the years, days, hours and minutes and seconds that the side's been in the Bundesliga, which is basically saying... don't get relegated. what's the crisis, Barry?
Well, they've had a very poor pre-season and speculation. They lost a lot of games and speculation abounds that they may only win the Bundesliga by 10 or 15 points.
Disaster.
Sound the Bayern Munich crisis klaxon.
Presumably everybody wants Dortmund to win the league because they don't like Bayern and they don't like Leipzig and they don't like Hoffenheim. And in Serie A, Milan have spent a lot of money, got Leonardo Bonucci from Juve and got Donnarumma on a contract extension. Producer Jonathan was telling me that they've also signed Donnarumma's older brother. Has anyone seen this? Who is a sort of pretty useless 27-year-old goalkeeper who was there when he was very young and didn't do anything great, and he's been signed on a 4-year deal. And then they released a statement saying, we're not doing this just to please his younger brother.
Because Chelsea bought Thorgan Hazard, didn't they? Aiden's brother, which is...
There's another Benteke, isn't there, at Palace?
Yeah, there is another. There is a Jonathan Benteke.
Jonathan Benteke's at Palace, yeah. But he's not useless, you're saying, about...
No, I think the Hazards are all pretty good.
Are they?
Isn't there five of them?
I think. Five Hazards?
That are all professional footballers.
Chemical, nuclear, Aiden.
Bio.
You'd have fun if your surname was Hazard. It's a bit like, is it Modu Barrow? And I really want him to call his kid Wheel, but he won't do it. And then I really want Bakary Sacco to marry, Danny Shittu's sister, and then their surname would be Sakashitu. And I've gone blue again.
How long did you spend working those ones, in idle hours?
Then there's that commentator, Ian Crocker, and he could marry another one of Danny Shittu's sisters. Then they'd be the Crocker Shittus. I haven't gone any further.
Those family get-togethers are great. The Crocker Shittu and the Saka Shittu.
It's Buffon's final year. He's planning to retire after the World Cup. That's interesting. And Italy have Serie A has 4 Champions League spots for the first time.
I think Serie A is getting increased. I mean, God, this is so basic, it's not true. But, you know, it's getting more competitive. The standard is up again. There's more money in the league. There's some exciting players in Serie A. I think that's probably the division to look out for this year.
If only we had an expert.
We do. He's just not here today.
Yeah, that's true. Paolo is excellent. You were saying it's not the first time they've had 4, Jonathan. In my ears.
Didn't they had 4, then they lost one.
Coefficient news.
Oh, okay, they're back to 4. There you go. Well, that's something for people below the line as we end the podcast, isn't it? Do you want some tweets? Steve says, is Crawley versus Cambridge this Saturday the season's first 6-pointer? I think Crawley have 0 points as well as us. So that's good. But we do
look. Harry Kiel. He's in trouble, isn't he?
He is. As is Sean Derry, but I believe in him still. Jonathan writes, can you just talk about Leeds for a bit? Just a little bit, please. Winky face. Paul McInnes.
Well, they got, you know, new owner, new coach Andreas Christensen, come in from Hapoel. They've had a decent start. They've still got Chris Wood, who's the subject of up to £20 million bids from Burnley. I think the question is, Chris Wood never had a season like he had last season. He's always been in and out of teams throughout his career and scored in streaks. So the question is, yeah, can he do it again? But, you know, Britta Sombolonga should be playing in the Premier League, and you can see why somebody would want to go for Chris Wood too.
All right, there you are, Jonathan. We did what you asked for. Thanks very much for your time, Paul.
Pleasure.
Jacob, thank you. Thank you, Barry.
Cheers.
We will be back on Monday. Feel free to subscribe, like, review, all those things, as long as they're nice. And we'll see you on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.